Oh yeah. Oh wow.
Did you see them? They're holding up mood
signs.
Oh
man. Oh, that feels good.
They're ignoring me on the stage and simply holding up signs.
Well, you're in a hot dog costume, so.
Yes. Well, I did that to get more cheers, not less. Welcome to Carl Landry Record Club, music podcast from the rights to Ricky Sanchez. That is our music intro that you just heard is from Marian Hill. That is called I Should Let You Know. We do two albums and a new song on almost all of our podcasts with the idea to appreciate music that you love, like share the ones that you love and learn about the ones that you don't. You can submit an album. We do two albums. I said every time we pick an album 1 week that we love and you pick an album. You can do it by going to carllandryrecordclub.com or, you know, if you're listening on Spotify, there's a box right beneath the player. You could suggest one. You could do one of the Apple Podcast reviews. There's lots of places. You can do it on social. Lots of places to do it. You know how to contact us. Shouldn't be that easy. Google us. Google. You don't know? Google.
Isn't that sort of a comeback? Like when someone...
Google me.
Yeah, Google me.
Yeah, Google me. Yeah, I've unfortunately been pushed to that now and again, you know?
Is that just a reality, I think, sometimes of being in broadcasting in some way, especially in a format like sports talk?
Yeah.
Like you got to have certain... Those kind of comments are like a sword sometimes. You got to wield them every once in a while.
Every once in a while. That's the only one that I pull that out for usually is from the you only got your job because of your dad stuff. And I'm just like, could you Google my successes, actually? Could you?
My successes? When it comes to that kind of thing, you know, yeah. People are like, that's the low-hanging fruit.
You're going to go low. I'm going to go even lower, buddy. You know, I took Michelle Obama.
When they go low, we go lower.
Yep. I took Michelle Obama's advice and I flipped it on its head. So
I like it.
You're gonna take a cheap shot. I'm going to take a cheaper shot. You know, you're going to say I only got my job because of my dad. I'm going to say, look at how ugly you are in your profile picture. All right, two albums.
Yeah, what a start! To the pod.
Two albums and a new song today. Listener album is from Anderson .Paak. It is called Malibu. Came out in 2016. Came to us from Justin, who sent it in on the website. Justin says, "Hey, gents, got turned on to the show from the 2023 end of the year show out on the Ricky. Occasionally, we'll put these on the rights to Ricky Sanchez feed. Just want to shout out the appreciation of doing an Alkaline Trio album. I was a big fan of some of the punk bands coming out of Chicago, like Alkaline Trio and Rise Against. Of course, that album was with Dave Hartley from War on Drugs, where he obviously hated the album completely, going against the concept of the podcast. So maybe
this come a few times, but we did Harry Nilsson and Simon yes. Garfunkel, which are two records that he and I loved.
Yes.
And then the other one was kind of outside of both our wheelhouses. So I think maybe there was just an imbalanced seesaw situation there. That's how I like to describe it.
For sure. You like to take it easy on Dave, who was obviously too negative on Alkaline Trio. That's what I'm just saying.
He's such a nice guy. Come on.
He is a nice guy. Anyways, my album request is Malibu by Anderson .Paak. The album is pure good vibes, blending hip-hop, R&B, some soul music. It's an album I just keep coming back to. So that came out in 2016. Mootloo's album is DJ Shadow's... is DJ Shadow's Introducing... Came out in 1996. Can't believe that album is almost 30 years old, which is fucking insane.
I was actually thinking about that as I was listening. I was like, oh man.
Yikes.
Wow.
And the new song is actually a formerly unreleased song, released most recently from Linkin Park, called Friendly Fire. So obviously there's not a new Linkin Park song, not at least with Chester Bennington, as he has passed away, but is a song they recorded before and recently released. So there you go. Well, we start with Anderson .Paak, then do Linkin Park, then we can do DJ Shadow. Does that work?
Cool, sounds good. All in the back of your head. In the palm of my hand, ain't nobody holding you back. Don't it feel like it's been far too long, girl? Your heart don't stand a chance, your knees just wanna break. Your eyes keep me all in the trance, and then me ask you.
Anderson .Paak, born Brandon .Paak Anderson to a black father, Korean mother in Los Angeles in 1996. He actually had a stage name before he settled on Anderson .Paak, which I like way better and would be a great podcast name, Breezy Lovejoy.
That was a previous name?
That's to me, it's a winner. I might not be
Anderson smooth, .Paak. That's smooth, man.
Yeah.
Smooth.
Breezy Lovejoy. You certainly have a name to live up to with a specific kind of music if you go by Breezy Lovejoy.
I think it's got
to
be like 70s soft rock or something.
The Breezy part of it, for sure, yeah. He had sort of a chaotic childhood. His parents were not together, but his dad went to jail for attacking his mom pretty violently when he was 7 years old. Then when he was in high school, his mom got convicted of fraud, frauding investors of her produce company, and went to jail as well for almost a decade. So a chaotic childhood for sure for Anderson .Paak. Did all kinds of music stuff when he was younger, played drums in his church choir when he was in high school. He started writing and recording and producing music in his bedroom. And then all the way in 2011, he ended up homeless because he lost his job. Where was it? At a marijuana plant. He was actually married and had a kid, lost his job, ended up homeless, and got hired to do some audio and video and production, his first real job in music by a hip-hop artist and a soul artist. And it got him on his feet and gave him access to a studio, and he was able to record and release his debut, OBE Volume 1, which was released independently in 2012. So, and that was when right before then, that he settled on Anderson .Paak at his stage name. Then he did, I recommend looking this up because it's not on Spotify, but it is on YouTube. He did a covers EP called Cover Art. And he said that he was sort of like interested in the white artists in the 50s and 60s that covered songs from black artists that gained popularity, and decided to sort of like flip that on its head and cover like white artists on his thing. So he covered some like alternative stuff. He covered Seven Nation Army by the White Stripes.
Every single one's got a story to tell.
Covered Maps by the Yeah Yeah Yeahs and certainly put his own spin on it. It was like a super interesting EP that you should, again, not on Spotify. I don't know if it's on Apple Music or not, but it's definitely on YouTube and worth checking out.
You can hear some of the rock influence in what he does too. It's definitely there.
Absolutely. I actually think sometimes in the more hip hop focused tracks is when you hear the rock influence more, I think, you know, I think you hear that as well. This is certainly an album, and the only thing I listened to from him was the cover art and this album, but like we've done a lot of albums, I think in total, talking about the combination of different genres, and this album is for sure, you know, that there's a lot of different stuff in this album. He started to really gain traction after he put out an album in 2014 called Venice. And then he got noticed by Dr. Dre, which is not a bad person to get noticed by, and produced and appeared in songs from him, from The Game, from Schoolboy Q, and then got signed to Dr. Dre's Aftermath label. So, you know, of all the artists in the world to get noticed by and signed to their label, Dr. Dre.
You're
going to
suddenly have a massive new platform. Then he played drums when they did the Dre, Snoop, Eminem halftime show.
He did.
He was playing drums because he's a great drummer. I've seen him. I mean, he can really play.
Yeah, he did some studio and touring work. It was one of the American Idol contestants he ended up playing drums for as well. Like it seems like he became... It's interesting that the album is so full of different genres and so full of like different instrumentation, because his sort of value early on seemed like it was pretty utility person-ish, in that he could play the instruments, he could produce, he could do all of those things. And I think you sort of hear that in the music itself, you know, his sort of wide breadth of different talents, you know. So then after Aftermath, he made this album, Malibu, which produced by .Paak and Ninth Wonder, a DJ that goes by the name of Ninth Wonder, that's done a ton of producing as well. He said, when I was doing my album Malibu, I went back and studied a lot of artists from the 60s, which is probably my favorite era of music. Mentioned Otis Redding and Sam Cooke. And then he also said, which is interesting because the album sounds like there are a million different like people playing at once, almost. And it doesn't, I don't think it sounds overdone, but he said that it was recorded on a dented mic and a Mac Mini in the corner of his house. But the production value is so rich because of my ability to compose music with a vibe and a sound. And also, another interesting thing you mentioned, rock. He said, we wanted the album art to have a classic 70s rock feel. Who worked on the album, the guy, Dewey Saunders, who worked on the album art for him. And they said the artwork was inspired by Hypnosis, the London art firm that did album covers for Zeppelin and for Pink Floyd. That was in another article. I actually think this album is interesting to do at the same time as Introducing, because I do hear some similarities in the production, most notably the, first of all, that sometimes like instruments will come in and out for a section of the song and disappear. Also sort of like sampling vocal stuff in a, not like sampling a hook, like, you know, Diddy, like Puff Daddy did at one point, but almost like having vocal samples from other things sort of thrown in there. I think there is a similarity to the production in both albums.
There's sort of a musical collage component to both of them.
Yes.
You know, and the feeling of, you know, there's programming involved in what's happening, but it somehow transcends just feeling like a record that's purely programmed. There's something, there's, especially with the Anderson .Paak record, there's something very live about it.
Absolutely.
But even with the DJ Shadow record, there is more of that than you would anticipate for something that was just done on an MPC.
Your point about it sounding live is absolutely true in that. And that was one of the things I thought about when I said that I felt like there were a lot of people playing. You can almost see them. You know, like I guess I sort of feel like this album, when listening to it, I can see them enjoying playing the music. And I almost feel like I see a full room of musicians, like sort of jamming's the wrong thing, I guess, but sort of, you know, enjoying playing the music and collaborating. It feels like a true like music collaboration in some way. Does that make sense to you at all?
Absolutely. When I've seen clips of him playing live too, that energy comes across.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. And so I mentioned the similarity to DJ Shadow. There's a track called The Season Carry Me, which is... Honestly, like one that reminds me of DJ Shadow the most. And it, the other thing that I thought was interesting is sort of the diversity in vocal attack, from a sample here and there to rap to almost like a raspy soul vibe. And then there's, he seems to have like choir in almost every song, you know, like a, which I love. It almost sounds like, it feels like cheating sometimes, but every time I hear it, I like it. It's like hand claps. You put that in there, I'm going to end up liking it.
It's always going to give a different dimension, a different kind of energy lift.
Yes.
And the way he does it is it's not predictable.
No, not at all.
Sometimes the vocals are kind of jump in and out, or they'll be a response to something he's doing in his lead. It's creative, and the arrangements are very unexpected sometimes, the way he puts it together.
The first track on the album, The Bird, is a, we talk about this all the time in terms of like first songs on albums, but it's an excellent way to kick off the album, in that not every song on this album feels like a party vibe, but this one definitely does.
A bird with a word came to me, the sweetness of a honeycomb tree. And now I look what's taking over me. Couldn't fake it if I wanted to. I had to wake up just to make it through. I got my patience and I'm making do. I learned my lessons from the ancient rules. I choose to follow what the...
And somehow has so much musicianship and so many instruments without, to me, it without sounding overproduced. Also some like interesting lyrical lines in there. I choose to follow what the greatest do is like an interesting sort of acknowledgement of his sort of like direct influence, like being influenced by, you know, other musicians and the past. And a note about his mom's troubles, my mama caught the gambling bug, which may inform why she got convicted of fraud at some point. So I think it does an excellent, like excellently combined genres and sets a tone for the rest of the album.
It's an interesting combination because it does have that party vibe, but you get a lot of his personal story.
Yes.
There's that whole section. You mentioned the one line about, he talks about his mother, and then mm-hmm. he references his sister, his uncles. He kind of gives you a brief snapshot of his family. And yep. You don't always hear that. Some, you know, something's kind of upbeat, grooving party vibe. You normally think the lyrics are going to be light, but he does this thing sometimes where he'll actually get into something pretty heavy.
Yep.
In the midst of all that. But it's a easier delivery system because the groove is there. So if you, it's not like the music is very solemn or heavy, but
no.
he can get into real. That's one thing I took away from the whole record is he's just incredibly talented musically and his mm-hmm. productions and arrangements, but there's a lot there lyrically too.
Yeah.
The more time you spend with it, there's nothing trite about any of these songs. He really goes into some interesting spaces with just telling his story or social commentaries or whatever it might be.
There are a couple of tunes that feature, there's one that has The Game in it, one that has Schoolboy Q, but like from a hip hop standpoint, I think my favorite one is Come Down. I don't know if you noticed this, and maybe I'm just hearing a similarity, but there's a song from Kool and the Gang called Hollywood Swinging that Mace's Feel So Good samples, and it almost doesn't sound sampled in this, but the dun, 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 it feels like it's
similar.
Is sort of,
there's a I think that it channels that song somehow.
Yeah, for sure. The guitar part in it feels the same. That guitar lick feels the same, and the song has an aggressiveness and a sort of like an assault that I don't think a lot of the other songs on the album do. I really enjoyed that tune. And then the other one I liked was Put Me Through, which is...
Got that one on here. Yep.
Yeah, that's a Mutlu one. It's certainly the most throwbacky on the album, I think. Afraid of thinking I dug my own grave. Fuck around with this strange and elusive. Too afraid to lose it. A great chorus on this one from a song standpoint is a great chorus, great use of that choir on this song. And I think he uses piano really, really well in the album, but it feels like piano is kind of the music star in this particular song.
That tune made me think of Curtis Mayfield. Almost as if Curtis Mayfield was making music today.
Yeah, yeah,
you could imagine him doing something like this.
Yeah.
And they have a similar timbre, too. Sometimes Anderson .Paak's timbre reminds me of that lighter falsetto that's kind of on top of the music. It's not, he's not over singing, but, you know, Curtis Mayfield could have like a whole orchestra behind him, but then the voice would come in and would still be right up front.
Yeah.
And this song has a similar dynamic.
I imagine this would be this felt like an album you would enjoy. I couldn't tell if it felt like an album, if it was like too much like that, and if you would have thought it was cheap. I was curious what you would think of this one because it felt like a Mutlu album.
No, I love this. This is okay. Right.
All right.
In my wheelhouse. A couple other tunes that I'll maybe Season I Carry Me, that one.
Yeah.
That tune I think really showcases what he does vocally.
Yeah,
he does that perfect hybrid of the rhyme style and the singing. And I've heard other people do that, but he has his own very particular way of doing it where the rhythmic cadence will sometimes be basically like he's, you know, laying it down more like an MC, but there's always a melody in it.
Yep.
There's always some singing that goes into it. And there's also a poetic cadence to how he delivers some things because you could almost hear him pull back and just do spoken word versions of some of these tunes. And when you look at the lyrics on the sheet, it lays out like that. Mm-hmm. There's a lot there, a lot to get into. And then one other tune that really stood out to me was towards the end was Celebrate.
Yeah.
That one just has that feel good, classic soul sound. But one thing, it's like I kind of mentioned earlier, it's occasionally when you channel that retro sound or something nostalgic, there has to be some meat on the bones lyrically, or it could just sound like a genre exercise or maybe a bit trite. But that never happens, because when you break down the lyrics of that one, for example, it has that upbeat feel, but there's a little more to the lyric than you would think necessarily. It's really a song, like an existential song to me, about trying to appreciate the day-to-day, which that concept in and of itself is not anything new, but the way he puts it together, there's like a few lines. He said, "Captivated the fruits of my family tree. Where would I be without you? What would you do without me? I'd be a bare luck. What could have been? So let's celebrate while we still can." There's always some, there's always a turn of phrase in his songs, or something that lyrically makes you want to go back and say, "Oh, what did he say there?" And then you couple that with this, his ability to just channel late 60s, 70s soul, it's, you know, right in my wheelhouse.
I think if I were to give any criticism, and this happens with self-produced albums a lot, is that, like, it could be a little shorter. It's like...
Yeah, it is long. It's definitely long.
Yeah, especially for this kind of album. It's not like a concept album. It's not telling a story. It's 16 songs and like over an hour, which if you're not Pink Floyd or something is like... at this point in my life, I don't love it. But actually, this is the, you know, an issue sometimes that you have with the digital age, is that when you don't have to fit the album on a, you know, by the time CDs came, I think CDs, the longest you could do was 71 minutes or something. But before that, you would rarely see anything, you know, vinyl, I think, is closer to 50 minutes, and cassettes, usually you didn't see anything longer than an hour. But without those limitations, I think there are some advantages, and maybe you get a song you wouldn't have gotten before because they would have had to cut it. But also the disadvantages, sometimes you get songs that would have gotten cut otherwise. So it's a little much to take in, I think.
It's a double-edged sword, because like you said, there might be that unexpected tune that wouldn't have landed there otherwise. But then imagine the 10 or 12 best songs on this record, because there's a lot of great songs here. And if it was that more compact,
right,
then your perception of it might be even one notch stronger.
Yep.
And then the easy thing to do nowadays is people put out a record of 9 or 10 tracks, whatever, and then 6 months later, there's the deluxe version. So this could have been like the deluxe version.
Yeah.
But you still have the original. I'm still a fan of, you know, 8 to 10 tracks, 35 to 40 minutes, I think.
And we don't see a lot of those, honestly. Like 35, we've gotten plenty of them on this pod, but like you don't see a lot of albums coming in under 40 minutes, you know.
Yeah, and I think it's because also I don't think people necessarily think of the presentation as a whole as much anymore.
Right. Yep.
If it's just tracks and tracks and tracks, then, you know, it's different if you go into it with a concept, you want these songs to all be one presentation. But I don't know how many people are thinking of it that way anymore necessarily, if it's not even pragmatic to think of it that way anymore.
I think that's actually a good seg into Friendly Fire from Linkin Park, interestingly enough, because this song was actually written for One More Light, the last album they did with Chester Bennington before he passed away, which came out in 2017. But it was a song that they all loved. For One More Light, and did not make the cut. They decided to hold it for something else at some point. And they were a band that I felt like all of their albums were incredibly compact and they thought a lot about making sure that every song on the album was a banger. And I think they actually suffered from a critical perspective sometimes, because I think like when you have an album where every song is good, it almost feels like you're like too aimed at commercial success or something, or there feels like there's something cheap about it. But like, to me, it's amazing that every one of their albums, even the ones I don't like as much, don't really have any filler tracks on them. Most notably their first two albums, but One More Light as well. So they released this in advance of a singles collection called Paper Cut, named after the first single on their first song, or the first song on their first album rather, which comes out next month. It definitely sounds like a song from One More Light. I mean, in retrospect, I think that album is the saddest to listen to think about Chester Bennington and his suicide. I think if you go through all of Linkin Park's songs, you hear what he's struggling with a lot. But there seems to be on One More Light almost like a resignation to it, to what he is fighting, and which is sad to know that he did, you know, lose to what he was fighting and resign to it. But this song sounds like something that came out from that. It was written by Mike Shinoda from Linkin Park and John Green of the band The Bonfires. Shinoda said, there was a song, a One More Light song that we mixed. We mixed more than the finished album, and we mixed a couple other songs just to see if one of them would make the cut or if we could use it for a B-side, and it was Friendly Fire. John Green co-wrote, I wrote it with John. I think it was me, John, and Brad Delson from Linkin Park. And I still love that song. Every album, we've got so many songs that we make. And, you know, they're not, some of them are just really like half-cooked, half-baked conditions. So, I mean, I think fans tend to be very optimistic about those types of things. In their imagination, there's some gem that's the best Linkin Park song sitting on a hard drive somewhere. I promise that's not the case. The best stuff is always the stuff we put on the record. There are some songs that we were like, oh, this is really good, but it's not better than the record. Some of it is like a verse and a chorus copied twice. Some of it is that's the second verse as well, half done. It's not done. I think that's really interesting, like to have someone say, hey, we have a great idea here, but it isn't a full tune, so it doesn't get to be on the album.
And is this, that was in reference to this song maybe?
No, that was just in reference to songs in general, like unreleased songs in general, things that they worked on that they didn't end up releasing. But what's it called? Brad Delson, who plays guitar on Linkin Park, said Friendly Fire was always one of our favorite songs from the One More Light sessions. Something about it wasn't quite right. So as close as it got to the finish line, we chose to set it aside for later. When we started looking for an unreleased track to include in our greatest hits collection, I was blown away by the power of the song, the power of the storytelling, the power of the vocal, the sonic landscape, and I actually thought that maybe it was closer than we had realized at the time. We got together to work on it and connect some of the missing pieces that, for whatever reason, hadn't revealed themselves during the recording of One More Light. I can't wait for people to hear it. It's such a beautiful, compelling, heartbreaking, and hopeful story that resonates with me today. And I think that this song could have been on the album. Like, this is a great song. It has the classic Linkin Park, you know, put a nugget of the chorus up front, which they do sometimes too, you know, like they almost write songs like a great sports opinion. Like I always say, great sports opinions aren't, you don't build up to the take, you lead with the take, and then you sort of like back it up afterwards. And they do that sometimes. They give you like a little nugget of what the chorus is going to be. It's a beautiful song, I think.
It really is. It's the sentiment of the song is beautiful in the sense that it's something I think a lot of people can relate to.
Yep.
It's about trying to move beyond like past resentments that you have or people that you feel might have harmed you or that you might have harmed in some way emotionally.
Yeah.
You know, and it's trying to work towards a song about reconciliation, which has a sadness to it when you think about what happened to him. It takes on almost a different weight. But, you know, some of these lyrics, I mean, like there's a number of lines in here that really hit you. But there's a few lines about midway through, said, I was supposed to protect you no matter what's to come.
I wish you could look at my screen. Like, yeah, it starts, it's actually like seven lines right in a row starting with that one. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it just, I mean, those lines really, when you're listening the first time, just get you.
Yeah.
It says, you know, I was supposed to protect you no matter what's to come. Somehow forgot what they told me. We hurt the ones we loved. And that's, I feel like I understood what the song was right out of the gate, especially once I heard those lines. It's,
yeah.
There's a heaviness, there's a sadness to this one.
Yeah. And I think there's a sadness to this out. Like, that's why it fits so. I could have heard the song, and if you had asked me where it, like, when the recording came from, my guess would have been from right around One More Light.
Again. And that was which year exactly? That was
2017.
Okay. So that was their final record, and this was essentially an outtake from it.
Yeah, it was interesting when that record came out because I wonder, maybe I should put it on this podcast feed if I could find it somewhere. I did a podcast about after Chester Bennington died with Andrew Unterberger, who has joined us a number of times, writes for the Ricky, but also for Billboard, about Chester Bennington's you know, life and career when I had another music podcast called Love Songs back in the day. And it was kind of sad because this album got some heat from Linkin Park fans in general, sort of like that it was not a very heavy rock album at all. And the first one, the first single actually was written, co-written by Julian Michaels, interestingly enough. But the... It was just very strange to me because they had always been, oh, hi, Banshee. We're fostering another dog.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. You got like a new dog visiting you every week, it seems.
This is the third. Banshee is the most challenging of all of them, I think. She was very afraid of everybody and everything. So when we brought her over the house, she wouldn't even come near me. In about a week, she has certainly gotten comfortable. She has changed as a dog. Like, if you're ever thinking about adopting a dog and you bring the dog home, and this is just like a PSA, and for the first couple of days, you're like, oh, I don't know. I don't think this is going to work. Like, imagine waking up in a brand new place with people you don't know, where nothing is where you think it was. And you just came from a place where even dogs that do well in a shelter is like a traumatic experience.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Hundreds of dogs, a small space, sometimes going from a small space to having more space, what you would think is good is actually sort of like overwhelming for a dog. So, you know, if you're ever in that situation, you're like, oh, this is too hard. Just like, I would say, give it, I know this sounds crazy, but like, give it 2 or 3 weeks, you know, like the dog will change. But she's now like running the house or whatever.
Looks like she's a Linkin Park fan too, because she was hop up on a mic.
She wanted to hear. Yeah. Well, my wife had to go grocery shopping, and I was like, I usually close the door when I do the podcast, but I was like, I will leave the door open in case Banshee is curious about what's going on. And she was certainly curious.
Seems like she's just chilling though. So
yeah. You know. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Maybe early morning now.
Yeah. Early morning. She's just chilling. Poor Rebel. Like, Rebel like has accepted her, it's fine, but she likes Rebel a lot more than Rebel likes her. So yeah, she'll run up to Rebel. I've never seen a dog give other dogs a kiss in the face, but she does it every morning to Rebel. And Rebel's always like, can you get the fuck out of my face? Like, what are we doing here?
Rebel's a bit territorial, it seems like.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Anyway, when this album came out, there was a lot of pushback, and which I thought was interesting because to me, Linkin Park had always been, you know, had flirted with pop music and had always written such, you know, obviously great songs, and had always done genre bending from like doing an album with Jay-Z, you know, like they were always like that. And I was surprised at the pushback to this album. But it includes so many beautiful lines and so many sort of sad but pretty songs. And this would have been one of them.
Yeah,
what a great song
tune
to put on the greatest hits.
There's such an earnest quality to his delivery too. It's just which I think is a hallmark of their sound. I don't know their music very well.
Yeah.
But there's always something immediate, sort of a vulnerability in the way he communicates everything.
Absolutely.
This is a great example of that. And then sonically, I mean, it's vast. You know, there's a big, especially when you put it on the headphones, like, oh, there's a lot. It's subtle, but there's a lot happening there musically that gives it this sort of sonic sweep.
Yeah, I get sad about them. Like I miss them a lot. I think as a fan of theirs, sort of, you know, I loved them for a while, and they just sort of faded off in the background. And when an album came out, I would listen to it. But they had such a great library, and had such an amazingly big career, and such a sort of a wide spectrum of what their songs sounded like. And it's a shame, you know, like the don't know what you got till it's gone thing is true. But after Bennington passed, it was really hard. It hit me really hard. I was really sad when he died, and I'm really sad when I think about him dying, you know?
And it gets to something deeper in that, you know, sometimes people think fame, stardom, all these things are going to bring people a sense of fulfillment and happiness. And it's a cautionary tale that to not judge anyone too harshly, or that the grass isn't always greener on the other side, because I think sometimes people look at someone who's a celebrity or a star, music, film, whatever it might be, athletes too, you know, and they assume because of the success that this person, you know, is on top of the world. And sometimes that success actually amplifies.
Yes, it makes it worse.
Psychological, emotional trauma. And this is a very sad story, you know, but it's not uncommon. And sometimes that fame can actually really put someone to this place where they just feel like the walls are closing. It's claustrophobic. And, you know, it's thou shalt not judge too harshly, I think, is the best way to look at
it. For sure. I mean, I think sometimes it can create expectations that they feel like they can never live up to, you know, and even the constant attention is, yes, it's like when you get into it, it is a trade-off, but I think you could intellectually know what comes with it, but nobody understands what it feels like. And you could have all the money in the world, you know, and all the adulation in the world. And it does not, to your point, it's rare that those things fix what ails you. I think it's actually more likely that it makes it worse, actually. If you have trouble, I think a more well-adjusted person will handle those things better than a less well-adjusted person who is looking for those things to solve those problems.
Absolutely. Especially this age, more than ever, the constant scrutiny. Once you're really in the public eye like that, you know, that's, you don't have much time and space to yourself.
Yeah.
Which is a undervalued thing to have for some people, you know?
Yeah. So great tune. Why don't we do DJ Shadow, which we mentioned on our last pod as well, the DJ Shadow. So it was cool to bring this back again.
Yeah, I got inspired after our conversation on that record on the Salt album, which was an outstanding album.
Yeah.
And I think as we were discussing it, we both heard a thread musically with the production there and what happens on this DJ Shadow record. And it's crazy that this album came out in 1996, but really it was recorded around 94, 95. So it is really 30 years old. And
insane.
It's amazing to me. I always think of the first Rage Against the Machine album. This always comes to mind. This thought, every once in a while, there's a record. Doesn't matter what the genre is, but you could put it on 30 years later.
Yeah.
And it's going to have the same vitality, the same immediacy for you. That to this day, there's nothing to me that sounds like that first Rage Against the Machine record. I can't think of anything else. If it came out today, I'd be like, whoa, what is that?
And by the way, people have tried. Like it certainly inspired a lot of bands to sound like that. But that might be the best example of urgency in an album, like maybe of all time.
Yeah, I can't think of something else that's more immediate than that.
Yeah, you're like, holy fuck. Yeah, a total assault for sure.
And this album in its own way has the same thing, because I think this was an album that even for people who weren't into underground hip hop or producer DJ music, they caught on to this record. Like people who were just, you know, rock fans, or people who were maybe more into mainstream hip hop or more into just R&B and soul music. I think this record somehow transcended, because I remember thinking at the time I heard this, it wasn't too long after it came out, that this was the first album like this that I'd really gravitated to.
Yep.
You know, that's just an instrumental masterwork. So, and here's the thing, he's done so much great work since then, and I give him a lot of credit, because he's constantly pushed the envelope, tried to challenge himself. He's actually tried to work away from this, but this is such an undeniable masterpiece. I think this is always going to be the cornerstone of his legacy. So give a little backdrop on DJ Shadow. He's born Joshua Paul Davis in Davis, California. He's from the Bay Area. DJ and record producer. He started producing and making tracks from a young age. When he was in high school, he was working on four tracks, and someone who started at a young age in developing his sound and his style. When he went to college, he went to the University of California, Davis. He was on the campus radio station there as a DJ on KDVS. So like yourself, he was in the trade from a young age. You were college radio, what, from your freshman year on, pretty much?
Sophomore, so 19 years old.
So you've been in radio pretty much from
30 years.
Wow. But from the time you were an adult, you were in radio. So
My whole life. Wow. Basically my whole adult life. Like I've been in radio twice as long as I haven't been in radio. That's, basically
that's
if that makes any sense.
How does it feel all these years later? Do you really love it as much? Do you still get the same spark that you did maybe when you first started?
Anytime you have to do something, it's different than when you just want to do something. But I still wouldn't want to do anything else. you know, as a job. And I've certainly have had the opportunities to do those things and I've considered doing other things, but there's nothing, there's something about it that maybe I can't tell if it's because this is why I got into it or because I've been into it for so long, but I just feel like I instinctually understand it better than I understand anything else, you know? So I think part of that is how I grew up. Part of it is just me as a person, but also part of it is spending so much time doing it.
That's a beautiful thing. And I think also you've had the benefit of changing gears and doing lots of different things.
Yes. Yeah. Within radio. My jobs have been very, very different, from on air, off air, to music, to sports, to conservative talk. Like to regular news. Like I've done a lot of things. So, I've had that. I think that has made it more interesting than maybe somebody who's just done one thing.
That's, man, to say 30 years into something, you still love it. That's,
what, do you still love music?
Of course. I can't see doing anything else, you know?
Yeah.
It's one of those things. I always think of like people like you and I, we're lifers, you know? I can't picture doing anything else. I mean,
yeah, too late for me to turn around and do it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But DJ Shadow is also one of those people, started at a very young age and was at the campus radio station, started making tracks on his own. And started to make a name for himself. He was inspired early on in the early stages of a label called Moax, which was based in London. Mm-hmm. And if you remember any of the releases from Moax, which he was a part of early on, actually, but experimental hip hop label in London, formed by James Lavelle. But there were labels like this in the early mid 90s, especially in the early 90s, I would say, that were taking hip hop and just, I would say, even dance music, electronic music, and pushing the envelope and doing different things. And I think DJ Shadow was inspired by some of those releases. And it all came full circle when in 1993, James Lavelle, who's the founder of Moax, reached out to him and wanted to release one of his singles, bring it to a broader audience. And at that time, it was kind of the early days of that imprint. Now, when he first started coming out and first started releasing singles like this tune, Influx, some writers were saying he was trip hop. Mm. And it's interesting. Andy Pemberton, who was a music journalist for the magazine called Mix Mag, specifically described this as a trip hop track. And it makes sense. At that time, you had Portishead and Massive Attack. Mm-hmm. I would still say DJ Shadow comes from a very different place as far as the overall influence, because he's coming more from a hip hop place. And I think trip hop has that element, but it's something else too. It's a little bit of a different aesthetic, but you can see how, in all the mood, the atmosphere, there was some parallel there between some of his productions and what trip hop was doing at the time.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned my start in radio, like this album came out while I was at my college radio station I fell in love with rap music in my high school age. So it went right from that into this. So, and like it was also when I was learning how to mix vinyl. Like it was like we had a mix show at night. So this album certainly hits that point in time precisely for me, you know, and the trip hop stuff, all of that. Like this was an album that stands the test of time, but also feels like the time that it came out.
Of that very specific moment, right?
Yeah.
It's amazing when a record can do that you undeniably connected to a very specific moment, a very specific scene, in this case, even maybe a very specific label with Moax.
Yeah.
And also Soulsides, which I'll mention in a second, which was a Bay Area label. But then, you know, if it can transcend that and hold up all these years later, it represents an era and then gets past it. And there's not that much music that can actually do that. It's a harder thing to come across than you'd think. Also in 93, he was part of the creation of Soulsides, which was a Bay Area based label. A few of the early acts alongside DJ Shadow on that label were Blackalicious, legendary hip-hop group. We should probably do one of their records. And a guy that we discussed and discovered early on through this podcast, Lyrics Born.
Oh, yeah.
Who's just, to me, is an amazing artist. That one record we did, when was that? That was probably...
That was early on.
Maybe 4, 5, 6 months in, maybe.
Yeah, so, talk about a party album. You know, that album's fucking sick. That Lyrics Born album.
Didn't you have some interaction with him? Wasn't there a chance, there was some conversation of coming on the show and talk with us?
He said he would come on. By the way, this is, if you are an artist and can afford a manager, have a manager, because most artists like are hard to chase down on this sort of stuff. And I do believe they genuinely will come on, like that they think they will, but then like actually getting the details and getting them to commit and all that kind of stuff is like, it's too much work. Like I don't have time to be your manager and the person who wants the interview. So if you can do it, it is good to have somebody doing that stuff for you.
Because the time we did the pod, I remember he had sort of acknowledged it online and on Twitter and everything.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, this is okay. He's going to come on. Okay.
Yeah. Well, listen, I got tired.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Sometimes that legwork is too much, but a great artist. And when you think of a label that featured him and DJ Shadow, Blackalicious, another just like Moax, another label that was a trailblazer in a sense as far as this type of music, and you know, I think that was a golden era for me of hip-hop. I mean, I guess they say technically it's 88 to 93, mm-hmm. but you could probably push forward a little bit, even
years,
the late, yeah, more than that, I think, even late 90s with Raucous and Mos Def and Talib Kweli and some of the artists that came out there. Just the whole 90s to me was,
yeah.
I don't know if that makes me sound old or dated in my hip hop days, but that was just an amazing era.
I think, yeah, I go back and forth that too, whether it's just because of how old I am. I'm 47, so I should specifically like that era, but I also think objectively it is the best era.
It is.
Too. Yeah. It's certainly much better than fucking current. I don't know. Whatever.
It's evolved. It's changed. There's still some interesting things happening now.
For sure.
Musically, I just think as far as think of an artist like DJ Shadow, who I'm not sure a record like this, if it came out now, I think people who appreciate it would resonate in the same way. I'm not sure if it would have the same reach that this album did, because I think there was more of an embrace of that underground aesthetic and producer DJ music at that time. And then you think of Lyrical Virtuosos. I mean, so many of the great ones came out during that time. They're still around, too.
Absolutely. Jay-Z and Nas and Eminem and like all this.
Black Thought from the Roots. Yeah. I mean, you know, all, and even a little further back, we discussed one of his records, Rakim.
Yep.
Who, to me, is the godfather of all of it. I mean, mm-hmm. as far as the intricate, virtuoso level vocalist. But definitely a cool moment in time in the Bay Area with these artists, and he was part of that. Now, when this album dropped in 96, it did have a seismic impact.
Yeah.
On the world of hip hop, but not just hip hop, I think producer, DJ music, electronic music, and maybe even beyond that. In 2006, Time Magazine named this as one of its all-time 100 best albums, which is, taking everything as a whole, that's a significant accomplishment. But, you know, when you think of how influential it is within a very particular genre, it makes sense that it could make it onto a list like that, because it's something that has held the test of time. I've heard other people try to emulate this kind of record. I'm not sure that anyone, kind of like the Rage Against the Machine, I'm not sure that I've heard anything quite like this. The closest would be some of Madlib's work, maybe.
Yeah, I think its influence on production moving forward is the best compliment you could give it. And the fact that, I don't even know that I've listened to an album that even comes close to accomplishing what he accomplishes in this, like at any point. I hear his influence, but I've never listened to an album that even is in the same world as this is.
It's kind of on an island, I would say.
Yep. Yeah.
Now, in the years since this album, he's made half a dozen more records, although he's done a lot of other collaborations too, but Private Press in 2002, The Outsider in 2006, The Less You Know, The Better in 2011, The Mountain Will Fall in 2016, Our Pathetic Age in 2019, and then most recently, Action Adventure, which came out last year. And he's actually been touring behind this. He was actually touring in the States. He was playing rooms like the Union Transfer in Philly, and I think he played the Bowery Ballroom in New York. Now he's touring in Europe. So he actually has built a dedicated live following for what he does. And it's a testament. You know, a lot of times I think with this kind of record, if someone's going to tour behind it, you'd probably see it in more of a club lounge situation. You know, you could certainly tour behind this, but he's actually doing bigger rock clubs.
Yeah, 2000, I think Bowery and Union Transfer, probably 1500, 2000, something
somewhere
like that.
In that. Bowery might be a little smaller than that, but yeah, in that range, somewhere in that range.
Yeah, Bowery might be 1200 or something like that. I think Bowery's like TLA size, maybe a little bit bigger.
Exactly, and he seems to be doing rooms of that level, which you don't always see a producer DJ that has that kind of draw, but I think it's testament to his body work. One other record I should mention that came out right after this, again, the Moax connection, was an album called Science Fiction, by the project Uncle, which was something that James Lavelle. Yeah. Do you remember that record?
Yeah, I forgot about that record.
Yeah, but it was right around this time. It was a couple years later. And over the years, it's become a collective. Different producers and artists and musicians come in and out of the fold. But the early genesis of it was with DJ Shadow. And that debut album, Science Fiction, featured Tom York. It featured Richard Ashcroft from The Verb. It featured Mike D from the Beastie Boys. Cool G-Rap.
I remember the Richard Ashcroft song, actually. Now I want to look it up, but I remember that.
And that was a moment where I felt, okay, this is an interesting musical intersection where you have a producer DJ project, but now you have these rock stars that are coming in to work, and where rock music and electronic music intersected at a certain point.
Yeah.
And especially it makes sense. You think of someone like Tom York and the way they pushed the envelope with electronic music. But that was a really, really cool record. I remember listening to it. It's something I want to revisit. Maybe we should even discuss it at some point. I remember hearing it. I never spent as much time with it as I did this one, but I remember hearing it at the time. I remember hearing select tracks from it.
Yeah.
I think I remember the Richard Ashcroft one. I think I remember the Mike D track as well. There were some it definitely had a lot of traction. Now, also, in addition to that project and various other collaborations he's done, you know, when you look at the range of people he's worked with over the years, from Mos Def to Zach De La Rocha to Nas, to even more recently, King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. He's someone that I think people from a range of genres want to connect with and work with. If they you say DJ Shadow, it's like he's not limited to any one genre. I think he's transcended that. And his more recent work, if you've heard some of it, is not as sample heavy. He's moved away from that a little bit. And I think that makes sense. You don't want to keep repeating yourself.
Yeah.
But the genius of this album is, now think about this. You think of the orchestral level of this album, of the arrangements, of the sound. The equipment that was used on this record was an Akai MPC 12-bit sampling drum machine, a pair of turntables, and a very early version of Pro Tools. Now, at that time, Pro Tools wasn't the industry standard yet. He recorded this with the help of Dan the Automator Nakamura, who's another legendary producer. And Dan the Automator had an early version of Pro Tools. And that's all that was required to create the sound on this record. An MPC and two turntables and a very early version of Pro Tools. And when you look at the credits, it's DJ Shadow and assistant engineering from Dan the Automator. And those are the credits. That's the whole thing.
It's incredible to think that you could create an album that sounds like this with it, like with so much in this. Like if you were to create this album today, like you talk about Pro Tools, I could imagine what that file would look like, what the multi-track file would look like on a computer. And if it was an early version of Pro Tools, I don't know, with a billion different tracks, you know, it's unbelievable because it sounds like it's coming from 18 different sources, right? And also sounds so analog and warm that it could have probably only been achieved at this time with this equipment, with this person.
It's an amazing thing, right? I'm trying to picture the setup, but you know, an MPC, you know what that looks like, two turntables and a computer.
Yeah.
And all this came out of that. That's the amazing thing of musical creation, is the creating of something from almost nothing. You know, we think about songwriting, but that applies here too. The other thing I'll say is, when we think of a lot of our favorite hip hop tracks from back in the day, classics from the late 80s, early 90s, a lot of times it would be a 4-bar, 8-bar sample. And if you knew the original source material, you could draw a very direct line between that sample and what was in the song. You know, you recognize the riff. Everything was very clear up front. And then this was a new version of that song with new lyrics, a new hook. When I think of what DJ Shadow does with sampling, it's something else entirely. He took it to these unprecedented heights that I think many people have now tried to follow, where you can't immediately recognize the specific sample within it. You know, you can maybe hear a sound that you might have recognized from somewhere, but he puts so many different things together that rather than it just being a new version of a song and a groove that you recognize, it's actually an entirely new piece of music. I think that's what happens here when you listen to this record. So going through some highlights, I'll start. There's so many on this album, but I'll just do a few of them. This is the first full track. There's an intro track, but the first full track, Building Steam with a Grain of Salt. We'll be right back.
So cool.
Amazing, amazing tune.
Yeah.
Talk about an album that sets a track that sets a tone for the entire album.
Yeah.
That's this one. There's a cinematic quality to the mood and atmosphere of the track. It's built up around this very deep syncopated drum groove and a core piano sample. So yeah. It's not like those are the two core elements that are there throughout. And then it's just all the other things that surround those two samples. Basically, there are different spoken samples. And the first one that he uses, I'm not sure who it is. I used to always think it was him, but now I'm thinking it must be something he sampled from like a jazz musician talking about his craft. And he says, I'm a student of the drums and I'm also a teacher of the drums. And I like that he put that up front because in a lot of ways that production, this production style starts and ends with the drums. You know, everything else is kind of building off that.
The spoken word samples, I will never hear a spoken word sample and not think of this album every time I hear one. We did an album called Science Fiction by Brand New. We did that record, right?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, that was the first. We did two of their records, I think. Was that the first one?
We did Devil and God Raging Inside of Me, and that was the first one we did. And Science Fiction, which is their probably last album ever we did. But that opens up with a sample from what sounds like a science experiment or something, or a mental health experiment. But I thought of this album immediately. Never will I hear a sample like that and not think of this album. And I think it's such a haunting sound that I think he accomplishes with the piano and the drum, like even the effect he has on the drum. But what just like a mood setter. I actually thought, listen to this album, there's probably not a better album, a listen while you work album than this one.
Oh yeah.
You know, I have trouble listening to music while I work because I sing along and it takes my brain into the wrong spot. But this is one that can just get you into a groove and you can listen to without paying direct attention to it, you know?
And it works on multiple levels. Like you can put it in the background and it creates a nice atmosphere. But if you do want to key in on it, put it on the headphones and sort of go all in on it, then you start hearing things that are, I feel like every time I listen to this, there's something else that was there that I didn't notice before.
Absolutely.
And yeah, I totally agree. On this track we're talking about choral sounds or choral vocal pieces. The choral sample on this is just so beautiful. And it's the thing to me that puts the track over the top. And then what's interesting to me is that choral vocal sample mirrors the piano. So then I was thinking to myself, well, are they coming from the same
spot? Yeah.
Are they from the same piece or did he somehow find something? And here's if you really want to go granular, did he sample those two things from the same piece of music or did he find the one thing and find this other thing that just meshed with it? I think it might be the latter actually, because they don't sound like they're of the same thing.
Yeah.
If you just analyze the samples.
I hadn't even thought of that listening to it. That's an interesting call out. I do wonder where it came from.
Or like maybe he sped something up
to match it.
Yeah. I imagine it's something like that. And when you analyze these songs, if you just take the individual components, it's not that complicated. They're usually simple musical pieces. Yeah. The complexity comes in how he puts it together.
Yep.
And that's the genius of it, is that you can do that throughout almost every track. You can question, wait, what is that from? Is that, how did this mesh with that? How did he put that together? That's the sort of mystery and the magic behind it.
Yep.
One other tune I'll mention, well, I'll mention two more quickly, but Changeling. I don't know if it's Changeling or Changeling.
Changeling.
Changeling Transmission. It has this very sparse, spacious dynamic to it. Such a cool track. And on that one, there's so much just within the drums. There's a haze around the drums that almost fills the whole thing out. And then other little sounds, keyboard sounds, horn, vocal samples come in. And then one other thing I'll mention, which is kind of a tongue-in-cheek song, is the track Why Hip Hop Sucks in 96.
Thank you. It's the money.
Yeah.
And it's,
yeah.
And it's a 40-second interlude. Now, one thing is, it's such a great beat that it's kind of frustrating that it ends after 40 seconds.
Yeah.
You know, it's got this high-pitched synth thing that you recognize. I associate that with like West Coast hip-hop, that high-pitched synth sound. And then there's just a one-line vocal sample that says, it's the money. That's to answer the question of the title of the song. To me, it's funny to think that, because to me, that was a golden era of hip-hop. So the perception then, I guess maybe that's when hip-hop had become more mainstream.
That's what I was going to say. It's also the time that it blew up. I mean, it's right around the Puff Daddy time. It's even right around, you know, Jay-Z going from Reasonable Doubt to like In My Lifetime Volume 2, which is has Foxy Brown on it, has Babyface producing it. Like, it definitely changes right around that time. Now, I don't think it changed for the worse. I like that era of hip hop, but it definitely changed.
Yeah, to me, that's still a golden era, you know?
For sure.
It just had gone into the pop mainstream, that's all.
Yeah, but I thought it got better. I mean, maybe not better, but different in a way that I did not hate. I love both eras.
Yeah, that's, but again, we have, maybe we feel a nostalgia for it or a connection to it because that's around the time we probably discovered it.
Yeah.
You know, so you're always connected to things that you know, the sounds, the bands, the artists that first got you into music, you're always going to have a soft spot or a sense of nostalgia for them. But also this is another one. Another track that just, you know, the way he used that vocal line, there's a vocal personality to this album. Like you said, you'd never, if you think of spoken samples, you'll always come back to this album. There, even though it's an instrumental work, there is this vocal personality that he creates throughout, and just a masterpiece, stone cold masterpiece.
Yeah. So a couple other songs. You mentioned a short track that you wish there was more of. There's a track called Organ Donor that is less than 2 minutes long. Is sort of like an instrumental track that I want to hear a hip hop song over. Like, I want to hear a rap over. It's only 2 minutes and it almost sounds like he's showing off a little bit.
But just say here, a little tease, but then he's going to pull it away from it.
Yeah, it's awesome. And then two more. What Does Your Soul Look Like? Part four.
That's one of the best tracks.
It's a super cool and sort of like laid back and relaxed track in the album. But there are certain songs that just like remind me of movies, even if they're not in the movie. And this song, actually this whole album, but this song specifically sounds like it should be in Taxi Driver. Like, there's sort of like,
I just watched that recently. Man, that's a heavy film. Oh man.
Very heavy. But there's like, and I haven't watched it in a long time, and I can't remember if this is a scene, just a scene, or happens a lot, but there's like this part in the movie where you sort of see from his perspective, the streets of New York, the wet streets as he's driving the car, and he's talking about like the filth of the city and the things that he doesn't like. And the mood is, it's like at night, wet New York City streets. And this song, a lot of this album reminds me of it, but this song in general, takes me to that sort of place. And that is a movie that this album and specifically this song remind me of.
It does. It ties into the feeling and the ominous eeriness of that movie. You know, this is a very brief tangent.
Yeah.
A guy who I think in the history of film is unheralded is the guy who wrote that movie, Paul Schrader.
Yeah, it's funny. I wouldn't have even known him.
Everyone talks about, I mean, and with you know, deservedly so, everyone talks about Scorsese and De Niro. What about the guy that actually wrote the movie?
Yeah.
And really, a lot of what was in there was based off things that he was going through. And I think it's strange that he's overlooked. Not only did he write Taxi Driver, he wrote some of Scorsese's best ones. He wrote Raging Bull.
Yeah.
He wrote Last Temptation of Christ. And then he's also unheralded as a director in his own right.
We did American Gigolo, right?
American Gigolo, which is a great movie. Light Sleeper with Willem Dafoe. And
I've never watched that.
Susan Sarandon, that's one worth seeing. He's got another one that came out more recently with Ethan Hawke called First Reformed. He actually got an Oscar nomination for that one.
First Reformed is an intense movie.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah.
But that's vintage Paul Schrader. I was thinking, you mentioned Taxi Driver. I was like, why is the guy who actually was the creative mastermind behind this character, why is he overlooked? It's a strange thing to me. Sometimes how, I guess maybe it gets back to the thing that sometimes in the history of music, it's true too, that writers are kind of, to me, they're the most important piece of the puzzle, but sometimes they're sort of pushed to the back burner.
Actors and directors and occasionally and producers to a certain extent, but you don't often hear about writers. By the way, First Reformed is a very intense movie.
And a testament to what a great actor Ethan Hawke is. Because
he does a great job in the movie. There are two movies actually over the last, I think First Reformed probably the last 5 or 6 years that have come out that deal with religious overtones that are exhausting. And First Reformed is one of them. And there's a little closer to horror than First Reformed is called Saint Maud, which is another just give yourself some time to recover from afterwards would be my advice. And then the other song from this, Midnight in a Perfect World, is an amazing piano sample, amazing, like different spoken vocal samples in there, and another sort of haunting song like the Building Steam with a Grain of Salt. You know,
what an amazing album. I mean, this is just I just can never get past what it was created on. I know that sounds like a strange thing to be hung up on, but
seems impossible.
It seems impossible. Like if you just looked at that equipment and said, "This is what's going to come out of that," that's the amazing. That's the kind of the genius of what that intangible thing about music that we can't put our finger on that we love is that.
It's almost like if you saw, I don't know, Avatar, and we're like, you know, they made this in 1986 and those are all like physically made props.
Right.
And you're like, what? That doesn't make any sense. That is sort of like the unbelievable thing about this album is it doesn't sound like it's possible to have done that. But as like warm and organic and analog as it sounds, it does make sense when you listen to the vibe of it, almost that it would be, it sounds impossible to achieve this album without current technology, but it also sounds impossible to achieve this album with current technology, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, because I don't think it could happen now.
No.
It's a moment in time. Isn't that a strange thing that I wonder if he went back, could he recreate this from scratch? Probably not,
yeah.
It's just a moment in time, a confluence of things that we couldn't even fully understand or contemplate. It's just the magic. That's the magic and mystery behind it.
Great album. If you want to give us one, head to carllandryrecordclub.com. You can send us a suggestion there. Otherwise, we will see you next time.
Stay free, my goose.
Mm-hmm.